We're going to begin with one very short reading. This is from Ecclesiastes, and I'm reading from the Common English Bible. This is Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 22. We were meant to enjoy our work, and that's the best that we can do. We can never know the future. And that is so short that I'm going to give you two additional little blurbs. One is from Dwight Eisenhower. Neither a wise man nor a brave man lies down on the tracks of history to wait for the train of the future to run over it. And the other is from Steve Jobs, one of the founders and longtime CEO of Apple Computer. You can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backward. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. This approach has never let me down, and it has made all the difference in my life.
To the song Rebel Girl by Joe Hill, I left something about, if you know Joe Hill, written in 1915, he was in prison, wrongly, when he wrote this about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was one of the founders of the ACLU and a tireless advocate for workers' rights, labor union. Over decades and decades and decades, they were in correspondence while he was in prison in Utah, and he wrote this song about her. There are women of many descriptions in this queer world, as everyone knows. Some are living in beautiful mansions and are wearing the finest of clothes. There are blue-blooded queens and princesses who have charms made of diamonds and pearl. But the only and thoroughbred lady is the rebel girl. That's a rebel girl, that's a rebel girl to the working class. She's a precious pearl. She brings courage, pride, and joy to the fighting rebel boy. We have girls before, but we need some more in the industrial workers of the world. For it's great to fight for freedom with a rebel girl. Yes, her hands may be hardened from labor, and her dress may not be very fine, but a heart in her bosom is beating that is true to her class and her kind. And the grafters in terror are trembling when her spite and defiance she'll hurl. For the only and thoroughbred lady is a rebel girl. That's the rebel girl, that's the rebel girl to the working class. She's a precious pearl. She brings courage, pride, and joy to the fighting rebel boy. We have girls before, but we need some more in the industrial workers of the world. For it's great to fight for freedom with a rebel girl.
Thank you, Stephanie. I puzzled quite a long time over what to call this morning's reflection. The title that I have settled on is On Prognostications and Exhortations. Judge that when we're done. In light of what I read you a few minutes ago, I doubt that it will surprise you to learn that I'm going to talk about our future a little bit. I am not foolhardy enough to make predictions, because such things can make us look pretty ridiculous. I was reminded of that fact when I came across an account of the first general purpose computer. The year was 1946. The machine was called the ENIAC, and that stood for Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer. As you might imagine, it was developed for the Defense Department. The U.S. Army used it to calculate artillery firing labels for the Ballistic Research Laboratory. Now, it was enormous, but there were futurists of the day that pointed out that certainly miniaturization in the future was going to make computers smaller and lighter. Now, remember, this was before the transistor became widely used. So this is what popular mechanics had to say at the time. Where a calculator on the ENIAC is equipped with 18,000 vacuum tubes and weighs 30 tons, computers in the future may have only 1,000 vacuum tubes and perhaps weigh 1.5 tons. I share those numbers in light of Apple Computer's introduction of its latest laptop a few weeks ago. Less than 3 pounds, less than 3/4 of an inch thick. So you will hear no specific predictions or prognostications from me. But let's face it, the impending sale of the building that houses Presbyterian Church of the Covenant has us a bit nervous. But I would remind us that our future is ours to create. And as I look around this gathering, I see lots of good people whom I respect and admire and whose vision I trust. And so, however our future unfolds, I feel good about the folks who will help shape it and with whom I'll share the journey. I really like the sentiment expressed by author Pearl S. Buck when she observed, "One faces the future with one's past." Over the years, many of us have spoken with some regularity about what we often refer to as the church of our experience, and the references are often less than positive. But I think now might be a time when we can take heart in some examples from our past, both as Presbyterians and as members of Covenant. Presbyterianism is full of instances when good people did difficult things in difficult and uncertain times. So I'm going to share a bit of history with you. We'll begin in colonial America. Now, remember that one of the main reasons many colonists came to the New World was to seek religious freedom, not to be bound by the theology, teachings, and doctrines of any official state church. We take such freedom for granted today, but it was a subject of controversy and struggle from the early days of the colonies, well before the Revolutionary War. Many of the colonies had adopted the Anglican Church as their official religion, sort of negating what they said they were trying to escape. Clergy who were not Anglican, and we call them Episcopalian today, they were these non-Anglican clergy were referred to as dissenting clergy. They were permitted to preach as long as they obtained a license from the colony where they lived. So that's what a fellow named Francis McKinney did. He was a Presbyterian pastor from the eastern shore of Virginia, and he became a prominent figure around the eastern shore. One of the churches he frequented was the Hungers Episcopal Church in Bridgetown, a place that I had a chance to visit a couple of years ago when I was one of the eulogists at the memorial service for my best friend from college, an experience that I treasure. Francis McKinney didn't confine himself to the shore. He traveled, and often was invited to preach as he traveled. And he was arrested in New York in 1707 for preaching without a license. He was acquitted, but he was ordered by the colonial governor to pay the costs of his prosecution. The New York Assembly understood how unjust the governor's action was and enacted legislation forbidding such a thing from happening in the future. The case is recognized as a landmark decision in support of religious freedom. You will find a street named McKinney Lane on the campus of River Landing Retirement Community in Colfax. Still in Revolutionary War times, the name John Witherspoon may be familiar to you as a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was a delegate from New Jersey to the Continental Congress, but he was also a Presbyterian pastor, the only active clergyman, and the only college president to sign the Declaration. At the time, he was leading a little institution called the College of New Jersey, which we now know as Princeton University. In that capacity, he taught many leaders of the new nation, 37 judges, three of whom became justices of the U.S. Supreme Court, 10 cabinet officers, 12 members of the Continental Congress, 28 U.S. senators, 49 U.S. congressmen, and future President James Madison. In the truest affirmation of his notoriety, that one of the main streets at River Landing is Witherspoon Lane. I think it's a main street as you first drive in. There is no street at River Landing named for Samuel Austin Worcester. I think there should be. Worcester was a Presbyterian clergyman and missionary to the Cherokee in the early 1800s. He helped them resist the Indian removal policies of President Jackson and the state of Georgia, and he went to prison when he defied a Georgia law that evicted missionaries from Cherokee lands. And finally, when 16,000 Cherokee began the 800-mile Trail of Tears march in 1838, Samuel Austin Worcester was one of the few non-Native Americans who marched with them. And when his wife died on the way, he buried her in Mississippi and kept walking with the Cherokee. Closer to home, Covenant's Pastor Emeritus Z. Holler reminded us during homecoming celebrations a few years ago about the actions of Lee and John Forbes, members of Covenant, in the wake of the 1979 Nazi Klan shootings here in Greensboro. It was the last sermon Z would preach from this pulpit. I think it's hard for us today to appreciate the significance of Forbes and Dick's funeral service reaching out to folks affiliated with the Communist Workers' Party. But it was the right thing to do. Even though Z and Forbes and Dick's staff were advised by police to wear bulletproof vests to the memorial service. It may not top marching 800 miles with the Cherokee, but at that time, it was a brave thing to do. And maybe that's the most important lesson to take from this morning's history lecture, which I'm done with, by the way, you'll be glad to know. Nobody here will have the opportunity to march in the Trail of Tears. None of us will affix our signature to a document as momentous as the Declaration of Independence. But each of us can do what we can, when we can, where we are, with what we have. And it's really that simple. And it's really that difficult. Each of us has a responsibility as we move through this time of transition. But much of that responsibility is to intentionally continue to be who we are, doing what we need to do in community, in covenant with one another. There's a rock band called Jars of Clay. They perform mostly Christian music, and they have a song called Shelter, which is rooted in the communal spirit of the Psalms. The lyrics are a reminder of our interdependence. They're recurring, this is sort of a chorus. In the shelter of each other, we will live. We will never walk alone. When he was being interviewed about the song, the band's lead singer, Dan Hazeltine, had this to say. There is no power in love, no gravity in forgiveness, no consuming light in darkness, no incomprehensibility of joy if we forget that we belong to each other. I hope you paid attention to Jim North's arrangement that was behind us, and I was hoping it would be here today. He quoted Ernest Holmes in The Science of Mind in the commentary, and I think there are copies of it still around. The part of the observation was, it is by giving of oneself to every person, every project, and every association with zest, love, and friendliness that one sees the larger possibility in all things. Something I value most about Mark's time among us is the way he's helped us reimagine some of the traditional trappings of the church of our experience. I'm going to propose to you this morning a reimagining of what in most Christian circles is referred to as the Great Commission. You can probably recite it to me. It's from the 28th chapter of Matthew. Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. And of course, that is generally interpreted to mean evangelism and conversion. I'll suggest to you that that's a mistake. over the last half of the last century. A Presbyterian pastor named Gene Peterson reimagined the biblical texts and rendered them in contemporary language. His work was simply called The Message, and many of you are probably familiar with it. It was published in sections and finally completed about 20 years ago. Here's how the Great Commission is presented in The Message. Go out and train everyone you meet, far and near, in this way of life. Then instruct them in the practice of all I have commanded you. The best metaphor for that instruction I've ever come across is a story told by a man named Alexander Papaderos, who founded an institute on the island of Crete, which is devoted to healing the wounds of war. If you know your World War II history, sorry, a little more history, you may know that the German invasion of Crete was especially brutal. It was the first time in the war that the Germans had encountered significant resistance from the civilian population. And so reprisals against those civilians were especially terrible. After the war, Papaderos came to believe that the Germans and the Cretans had much to learn from one another and that they had an example to set. For if they could forgive each other and construct a decent relationship, then any people could. I used to believe that such forgiveness was almost always possible. I'm not sure I believe that anymore. In recent days, there seem to be so many people who hate their enemies more than they love their children. To perpetuate ancient grievances in order to retain political influence, rather than to work with others toward more just and peaceful lives for future generations, strikes me as among the worst kinds of evil. But we can and we must continue to hope. I will leave you with this story that Papaderos tells about why he does what he does, and then use this lovely singing bowl that Ruth has loaned us for today to ring us into a few moments of silence. This is Papaderos. When I was a small child living during the war, we were very poor, and we lived in a remote village. One day on the road, I found the broken pieces of a mirror. A German motorcycle had been wrecked in that place. I tried to find all the pieces and put them back together, but it was not possible. So I kept only the largest piece, and by scratching it on a stone, I made it round. I began to play with it as a toy and became fascinated by the fact that I could reflect light into dark places where the sun would never shine, in deep holes and crevices and dark closets. It became a game for me to get light into the most inaccessible places I could find. I kept a little mirror, and as I went about my growing up, I would take it out in idle moments and continue the challenge of the game. As I became a man, I grew to understand that this was not just a child's game, but a metaphor for what I might do with my life. I came to understand that I am not the light or the source of the light, but light, truth, understanding, knowledge is there. And it will only shine in many dark places if I reflect it. I am a fragment of a mirror whose whole design and shape I do not know. Nevertheless, with what I have, I can reflect light into the dark places of this world and change some things in some people. Perhaps others may see and do likewise. This is what I'm about. This is the meaning of my life.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about good things to come. And I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world as one. And I believe it could be someday it's going to come. Get out on the edge of darkness. There rides a peace train, take this country, come take me home again. Now I've been smiling lately, thinking about good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, peace train sounding louder, glide on the peace train. Come on the peace train. Holy roller, everyone jump on the peace train. Come on the peace train, get your bags together, go bring your good friends too, 'cause it's getting nearer, it soon will be with you. Now come and join the living, it's not so far from you, and it's getting nearer, soon it will all be true. Oh, peace train sounding louder, glide on the peace train. Come on the peace train. Oh, peace train, holy roller, everyone on the peace train. Come on the peace train. Now I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss? 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train, take this country, come take me home again. Oh, peace train sounding louder, glide on the peace train. Come on the peace train. Holy roller, everyone up on the peace train. Come on, come on, come on, yes, come on the peace train. Yes, it's the peace train. Come on the peace train.
Again, thank you, Stephanie. We have come to that portion of our time together that some people call prayer. We can think of it as a meditation. I have a confession to make. When we are asked to bow our heads and close our eyes, I don't do either of those things. I choose to use that time to pay attention to the words, but also pay attention to the people and the space. So use this however suits you this morning. It's from Mark's book, Progressive Prayers for Progressive People, and it is on the past, present, and future. Sometimes we get so caught up in the planning the future and remembering the past that we miss opportunities in the here and now. Rather than focusing on the realities of now, We concentrate on skewed memories of what was or hopeful projections of what could be. Let us be called to each moment. May we stay aware of how the past informs them and be reminded of how, when stitched together in just the right way, they can create a better future. May we never gaze on the past or the future so steadily that we lose the opportunity of living in and experiencing love in each moment. Instead, let us be inspired to honor our past by carving out new and creative futures through the choices we make each day. Let us encourage, embolden, and empower each other to have the perseverance to practice love, even if doing so sometimes makes us feel uncomfortable, unsure, or unstable, simply because we are uncertain of what the outcome might look like. Let us learn to prize the journey and the love shared, trusting in the love more and more each time as we more fully embrace each moment and live in it. Amen. A slightly different blessing this morning. I will suggest may there be peace in your heart. May there be grace in your words. May there be love in your hands. May there be joy in your soul and in the song that you sing in living your life.